Okay, now I'm turning red. It's such a pleasure to be here, and we are just thrilled to be partnering with Anchorage Rotary East. Is that correct? Rotary East? And International and Kent, Washington. You know, we just love to partner with everyone, so I hope we can do this again. And it's my birthday next month, so if I come back, do I get cake? Okay, good. I just had to make that clear. We also have a basket, a bread basket. We do fun things, too, so we're going to bring some tickets up here pretty soon and draw and see who's a lucky winner of a Great Harvest bread basket. You want to do it now? Sure, bring it on up. Let's bring it to our illustrious speaker and see who the lucky winner is today. Okay, so if you are number 904201, you're going to make somebody very happy. 90, that's the guy. Congratulations. And I'd like to, thank you. I'd like to invite our speaker and Mr. Garrett Wong to come up and get all mic'd up while I finish up here, and so we can just make sure we don't have any technical difficulties. And while they're doing that, I'd like to remind everyone to either turn off their cell phones or put it on vibrate. Today's program is going to be recorded for the radio, for KSKA. We have 4,000 listeners who listen to World Affairs Council programs. And so if you wouldn't mind turning that off, our radio listeners would really appreciate it. If you'd like to hear this program at a later date or any of our previous programs, you can see a link on our website, or you can go to alaskapublic.org and download a feed and hear this program. I see a lot of our board members and former past board members, and it makes me realize what a connection we have with Rotarians. And so I'd like to recognize, is anyone in this room who is a current or past board member of the Alaska World Affairs Council? Would you mind standing up? Yeah. All the current and former past board members. Look at that.
It's on.
Fabulous. And if you are not an Alaska World Affairs Council board member or haven't been coming, please take one of our flyers. We have a lot of great programs on our lineup. We think you guys will all be very excited about, hopefully as excited as we are. And if lunchtime is a hard time for you because you have your normal Wednesday programs, we have a lot of evening programs coming up starting next month with a global education series and a stand-up economist. I don't know if there are any other stand-up economists out there, but we've got one coming. So we hope to see you for that. This program is also a special program for us. It's a Bev Power Memorial Program. And I'd like Phyllis to come up and just say a few words about what that means for us and who she was.
I'm not sure how many out here remember Bev Power, but she was a great moving force of the Alaska World Affairs Council. She was kind of the, when she wasn't president, which I'm sure she was one or two times, she was the force behind, the power behind the throne, you might say. You know what I'm talking about. There's always someone who's in charge, whether they're in charge or not, and that was Bev. When she died in 1991, we set up a fund in her honor, the Beverly Power Memorial Fund. It was intended that the earnings from that fund would finance a speaker, a well-known speaker, in her honor, annually if possible, but it depended on the earnings of the fund. When her husband, Jim, who was also active in the council, died, he left a substantial bequest to the Beverly Power Memorial Fund. So now we're able to do an annual speech on Bev's in Bev's honor. And our speaker this week is Ann. Say the name. Paula Brusensky. And she's going to address us on a current issue, the Ukraine. And this was Bev's thing. She always wanted us to be current with some international topic. So this couldn't be better. And I have the pleasure of having lunch with this lady, and she's a delight.
Thank you very much. And I'll turn it right over to someone who's near and dear to all of us in this room, Mr. Garrett Wong, who is co-chair of our board of directors and a longtime Rotarian. Mr. Wong.
Thank you, Lisa. I'm glad this thing's working because I was wondering. Well, listen, hello, fellow Rotarians of Anchorage East and also members of the Alaska World Affairs Council. It is really my privilege today to say, wow, we ought to do this more often. Not only do we have great attendance, but I think those Anchorage East Rotarians who've never been to a World Affairs Council event will be sharing in a different perspective of the world that maybe you don't quite get on national TV. So with that, let me give you a little background about Paula. You know, Paula is a senior fellow at the Harvard University JFK Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. She's also past chair, of the National Board of Directors, the World Affairs Council of America. Dr. Dobransky has a very extensive list of accomplishments as well as government services. And for a full summary of her resume, feel free to go to the Alaska World Affairs Council website, and we've got it all there for you. You know, she was a senior vice president at Thomson Reuters, where she held the title of Global Head of Government and Regulatory Affairs. And during that time, she also held the Distinguished National Security Chair at the U.S. Naval Academy. Between 2001 and 2009, Dr. Dobransky served as Under Secretary of State for Democracy and Global Affairs, by the way, the longest serving in history. She also led U.S.-India, U.S.-China, and U.S.-Brazil discussions on global issues, advancing international cooperation on environment, health, development, and humanitarian issues. Back in 2007, she took on the role of President's Special Envoy to Northern Ireland. And for the services rendered, she received the Secretary of State's highest honor, the Distinguished Service Medal. Paula has served as Senior Vice President and Director of the Washington Office of the Council on Foreign Affairs. Dr. Dobransky has earned a master's degree and PhD in Soviet political military affairs from Harvard University. She is a Fulbright Hayes Scholar and a Ford and Rotary Foundation Fellow. As a member of the Council of Foreign Relations, Dr. Dobransky's services are on numerous boards. She has lectured and published articles, books, chapters, op-ed pieces on foreign affairs and related matters. She has been interviewed widely on television and radio and has testified frequently before the Senate Foreign Relations and House International Relations Committees. Today, Dr. Dobransky is here to speak about Ukraine, some of the perils and opportunities that exist. Please help me in giving Dr. Dobransky a warm Alaska welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. But I am going to insist before we begin, you call me Paula.
All right, okay? Paula, you got it.
And let me say thank you, by the way, for that introduction. I was going to tease Dr. Zbigniew Brzezinski was a boss of mine, but I'm Dobransky. He's Brzezinski, I was going to say.
Fair enough, Paula.
And if I may just make one other comment, I do want to thank both the Alaska World Affairs Council, its president, Lisa, as well as the team here. Thank you. And also the Rotarians. As I mentioned, I feel connected from having had the privilege of receiving one of the fellowships from the Rotary Club, which has really done some amazing work in many areas. When I was Under Secretary of State, Rotary was leading the charge in an anti-polio campaign, which I got involved in. So with that, thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Now, the Board of Directors of the World Affairs Council spent hours coming up with a list of questions that we might pick her brain over. So we're going to share some of those with you today. So, Paula, you know, you're going to talk about perils and opportunities. Let's start with the perils.
Okay.
You know, the conflict in the East between the Ukrainian government and the pro-Russian rebels remains officially suspended as a result of a ceasefire. But, you know, violations are happening daily. What do you think will become of the ceasefire? And as a follow-up to that, are there any grounds for optimism?
Well, right now, I would say that no, unfortunately, there are, in my view, no grounds for optimism. First of all, because the Russians are even denying any involvement in Ukraine. They deny the fact that there are Russian troops on the ground. And, you know, one of the fundamental reasons why we know that there are troops, not only because of intel, but by the way, there are mothers who know that their sons are not back home, and they're gone. And actually, this is an issue that's going to be an issue that can become more of an issue for Russia if Russia continues the way it has in eastern Ukraine. But secondly, I would also add that in recent days, they've increased the number of troops in eastern Ukraine. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are well over, the numbers have been well over 1,000 in that very confined area. And thirdly, I'd say why I'm not so optimistic, and finally, is because also what we are witnessing is a breach of a ceasefire to begin with, but secondly, also provocations in the surrounding area. There was a recent provocation actually that took place against an Estonian at the border, and we see more and more of these things happening. I'm not optimistic.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Question number two. You know, almost everyone in the West accuses Russia of actively aiding the rebels, in not only in coordinating their activities, but sending soldiers into Ukraine, as you've just acknowledged. Mm-hmm. You know, what do you see as Russia's role in this conflict?
Well, first of all, you know, I have to step back and say, how did this all begin? And I will even move Crimea aside for the moment. Let's just take the eastern portion of Ukraine. You know, it's said over and over that you have people who want to leave Ukraine. You know, if you had asked me if I thought that there was going to be a secessionist movement in Ukraine, I would have told you that there's no evidence to that point. There isn't. There hasn't been a secessionist movement in Ukraine. That's not to say that Russians who are in Ukraine or Russian-speaking Ukrainians don't have differences actually with the central government, or that there are not necessarily some tensions that exist. There are, by the way, in almost every society that I know of. But the fact is that when Ukraine became independent, there was a referendum taken, and everyone, including the sizable Russian population in Crimea, voted in favor of Ukraine's independence and being and sticking as a whole. So secondly, when you look at what are the facts on the ground, who's leading the charge, you come up with two things. First of all, the person who is leading the charge in eastern Ukraine is imported, I'd say, from Russia. He doesn't live in Ukraine. This guy, Boyko, was from Russia and came in. Secondly, you also look at the facts on the ground. There are many people who are being paid in terms of taking positions. Thirdly, are there people who decide maybe this is a movement that they want to join in on? I don't know, but I will say that if it is, that hasn't contributed in the past to violence and to a use of force and for literally these kinds of pronouncements about drawing lines of, well, we are part of, as they term it, Novaya Russia, New Russia. So I would say that all of this started because of an invasion, because of literally a blunt and outright illegal aggression in Crimea, and then an illegal annexation. And I repeat again, that's not to say that in terms of ethnic, you know, is everything harmonious? I wouldn't say that. But I would say that people have always opted to resort to other means, either voting, using the ballot box, by the way, or peacefully demonstrating, but in this case, not the use of force. So in that sense, again, why I'm not optimistic, sure. This is definitely, the roots are from Moscow.
So, Paula, what do you think President Putin's strategy is here in Ukraine, or does he even have a strategy?
You know, that's an interesting question, because there are people in the foreign policy community who debate this. And I hear some analysts say that Putin is more reactive and he's seizing opportunities. Personally, I disagree with that. In fact, I even wrote an op-ed, and the op-ed was entitled "Expose the Putin Doctrine," because I'd start with this. First of all, when you look at after the illegal seizure of Crimea, Putin, by the way, gave a speech. And he was very clear in his speech in March of this year, in which he outlined what is his doctrine and his viewpoint. First of all, he said that when the lives of Russians anywhere, by the way, anywhere, are being challenged, that Russia has a right to undertake measures in order to address those concerns. Secondly, he also went on to say and literally counter the values that have been the values and institutions of a post, not only World War II, but post-Cold War environment, where he said, these are no longer our values. They're different, and we don't see them. Thirdly, he also announced his desire to set up a kind of customs union that would involve the countries that basically comprised, if you will, the former Soviet Union. And in that as well, politically, he talked about that being the greatest tragedy of this of the last period of where the Soviet Union was dismantled. He is on the record for saying that. Let me also mention one other critical point here. You know, interestingly enough, Gorbachev, when there were a lot of the changes taking place in the Soviet Union, you know, Gorbachev talked about Russia's role and his vision of Russia in Europe. And he talked about a common European home. Those were Gorbachev's terms. And at that time, there were overtures of reaching out, trying to look at ways of integrating. Russia, as you may know, has a membership on a council attached to NATO. Russia also said, do not deploy troops, put troops present in Poland or in the Baltic states on that forward front. All of these kinds of things were addressed. Russia also became part of the G8. It was the G7 before. There were various ways of trying to reach out and integrate. And I'm saying that especially because some in Russia say that these institutions were at fault for what happened. Hardly. It was an attempt to integrate. So back to the point, that's what Gorbachev said. Putin is saying that the dismantlement of the Soviet Union was a great tragedy. So in this case, my view is it's one, he has a vision of what he wants to achieve. Secondly, I think he is seizing opportunities in order to implement it. And opportunities have presented themselves for Putin in this case. But I think we need to be concerned going forward. And finally, I just co-chaired with a European participant, the former Polish foreign minister, a Japanese participant or co-chair, a former ambassador to the UN, and a Russian, by the way, participant, for what's known as the Trilateral Commission, interestingly enough. And interestingly enough, by the way, in our report, in our chapter, the North America chapter, we talk about Putinism and how this is very much grounded in Putin's personality. And let me add one more, forgive me, because it's part of Putinism. And that is, Putin is very, very concerned about Ukraine succeeding economically. He was very concerned also about the demonstrations in Ukraine and what it would lead to. And that the Russians would be looking across the border and saying, my gosh, look what's going on in their lives. And look, they're having these economic opportunities. So he was very, very concerned about what it would do about his own power base, which is also very much part of this. It's not only the doctrine that I mentioned, but it's also about domestic politics for him. Their economy is not modernized. You know that it's plummeting, and it is predicated certainly not on modernization and usage of its natural resources, very plentiful natural resources. Instead, it's all been banked and centered on its oil and natural gas resources. So in that sense, I think he's very concerned in the economically and what this will mean if Ukraine succeeds. Ukraine does better than Russia because that will wreak havoc internally in Russia. So those are the factors impacting his thinking.
Well, we'll come back to expanded discussion on his foreign policy. But now that you mentioned natural gas, you know, the natural gas issue, you know, what is the status of this gas dispute between Ukraine and Russia? You know, will that play a role in shaping Ukraine's policy towards the east?
Well, let me mention two parts to this. I just visited Ukraine in September, and I had the fortune of meeting, actually, the young head of Naftogaz, who just was appointed, actually, the head of the Ministry of Energy. And you know why I was a bit heartened? I like to look at it, and you asked about optimistic notes, and I like to be optimistic up front, particularly if you have someone who's new on the scene. This is a younger person, and he very directly said, you know what one of my missions here is for Ukraine? Diversify our sources to the best we can, because we need to do so in Ukraine, because we are too dependent and we're under the thumb of Russia in this case, and winter times are tough for us. But you know what the second thing he said, and he's the first person at least that I've met that has said this so squarely from that industry, he said, this is one of the most corrupt industries in Ukraine and in this part of the world. And I'm very determined to try to bring about a significant change here. And I thought to myself, he's going to have an uphill battle here, but those demonstrations on the Maidan, they were not only about this association with Europe, the European Union, but they were also about corruption. And people were tired of the monies that are going into building mansions, like Yanukovych. You may have seen the young journalist who was beaten up, the woman, because she did a story on that mansion. Right. Some of you may have seen it, some of you may not have seen it. But it was horrendous. So here, this young man, I think, you know, I hope that he will have the resources and the ability to do it. But here, Russia has worked out some strategy. To my knowledge, it's been working right now, meaning the Russians and Ukrainians have worked out a strategy. It's not one that is favorable to Ukraine for this winter. But secondly, I've given to you what I think Ukrainians are thinking of. They don't want to be under Russia's thumb. They want to have change in this regard, and they're looking at a greater diversification. And if I may just add a point about the United States, I see this as an opportunity personally for the United States. I know there's a debate in this country. I'm on the side of the debate of actually lifting up the kind of restraints that exist on getting our resources out to Europe and to countries in the whole European arena. As you know, there are positions, some that feel, no, we're not going to lift that kind of a constraint on exports. I think we should. And secondly, I will also say the silver lining of this, Europe is starting to rethink what it needs to do, because they are also very much constrained and they get their natural gas from Russia. And they realize they need to change and diversify and not be held hostage in their energy sector.
Well, speaking of that, are any of the sanctions then that the U.S. and others have imposed on Russia having any impact at all?
Yes, they are. I think that whenever you impose sanctions, I think the consistency of approach matters. I also think that if you have solidarity here meaning that it's the United States combined with Europe, and I will admit, and everyone knows this was not easy for Europe because in the energy field, they're much more affected, and also in terms of the volume of their trade with Russia, quite frankly. So when you look at it through an honest prism, you know, here there is some give and take as to what you do and how mm-hmm. you do it. I think that if you look at it, what the Russians even themselves are saying, that they are and have been impacted by this. I would say that if the situation does get worse, I would not take off the table the issue of looking at sectoral sanctions. But right now, at this particular point in time, I think the consistency of the approach, the fact that we've been unified, people have been sticking to it, meaning the United States and Europe. And thirdly, it hit sectors that are also impacting Russia economically.
So what about?
But by the way, that's not the only thing that can or should be done.
Okay. Well, that was going to lead me to my next question is, So what about the discussion then about giving military aid to the Ukrainians?
Well, my view is, and let me step back, you know, Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, came to Congress. I happened to be in that audience up in the balcony. He was there for the joint session. And in the joint session, it was really quite a powerful presentation. And I think one of the reasons why, there have been a number of foreign leaders have come and who've spoken before a joint session of our Congress. But, you know, they don't speak in English. And not to, you know, minimize the clarity, but when you do speak in English, you know, there's a real connection. And he did not just use his notes. He spoke to the audience. And I will tell you a word, if you didn't see it here in Alaska, I'll tell you, this is something that was repeated and repeated and repeated. He had a line. He said, you know, the United States is our friend, and we want to thank you very much for what you've given us, night vision goggles, and you've given us blankets. But you know what? Blankets don't win wars. And that line was repeated and repeated. The Ukrainians have asked specifically from us for lethal military assistance that they could use for themselves. I am in favor of that, personally. I do think that is appropriate in this case. It's a very specific request. Some people will give the opposite side, and let me give you the opposite side. It is, well, if we give this assistance, how do we know whose hands it will go into and what will come of it? 2 points. There are risks associated with almost any policy approach you take. You know, there's never a clear path, I'll tell you, in foreign policy. But secondly, in this case, there are things that we can and should be doing, and part of it is also training. They've also asked us for assistance in that regard, and also some help in that particular context. I did meet with the Ministry of Defense when I was in Ukraine, and actually, I do think that this has not, and I'm not going to suggest to you, anyone, and we have military servicemen and women here in the room, that this is the issue about looking at how and what they could do vis-a-vis the Russians, but it is also symbolic, because it gives an indication of backing their request, their direct request to us, and also providing that backing for what they need. Believe me, Moscow watches all of these steps. What kinds of sanctions are issued? What kinds of assistance is rendered? And, you know, what does that also mean for Europe and for NATO itself?
Well, let's go down to the trail then, back to the strategy of Russians. You know, Putin's pronouncement of justification for Russian annexation of Crimea was stated as, well, it's in defense of ethnic Russians. And so, you know, do you envision that this pro-Russian policy is a future tool of Russian foreign policy? And then to follow up on that, are the fears of the Baltic countries justified? Where, for example, Estonia has nearly 50% of its population is Russian. Do you think that these countries are going to be Russia's next targets? And on that heel, you know, is the NATO membership going to be enough of a deterrent?
Well, he's asked about 10 questions in that. I'm thinking, where should I begin?
We're trying to be efficient.
Very efficient. And I'll try to be efficient in my answers so we can also hear from all of you. Let me try to work backwards. First of all, in terms of the Baltic states, yes, I think they should be concerned because, interestingly enough, Estonia and Latvia, by the way, although these are smaller countries than Ukraine, the percentage of the Russian population is higher proportionally than in Ukraine. 17% in Ukraine, in Estonia it's 25%, in Latvia 26%. I believe that's the percentage. And so you have a high concentration. Secondly, I already mentioned to you there have already been provocations. There was one that was graphically a provocation vis-a-vis Estonia. There was also a provocation actually right in the waters near Sweden, by the way. So there have been little, you know, things that have been going on. And yes, also the Baltic countries have come forward, Lithuania in particular, and said that their contribution to NATO, they're upping the number. And not only the Baltic states, but Poland in particular, has really urged not just a temporary deployment of troops on the, you know, on that front, but actually a reconsideration of permanent troop deployment because of being members of NATO. Secondly, is this issue, and I'll the last one you asked, and then I want to move forward towards Crimea, but you asked about NATO. Look, NATO has Article 5. Far as I'm concerned, if you're part of a treaty and you're together, then you respect the terms of the treaty. What Article 5 is that when all countries have joined NATO, no matter how small, how large, basically, if you are attacked, that it's a collective deployment or collective defense. And in this case, if there is an attack, I believe that NATO has to respect Article 5 and come to the defense of any country that's attacked. But let me tell you, Most analysts are not talking about that. What we're talking about is not something that is so outright and so clear-cut. But, you know, now you have this hybrid war of what we saw in Crimea. Who are these people in green uniforms that were unidentified, had masks over their face? Where did they come from? Well, you know, the word was and is, I mean, they're from Russia. But the question is, what kind of, you know, action or overture, I'm using diplomatic terms, but let's say what kind of aggression vis-a-vis any of these Baltic countries, how would it manifest itself? And then how is that interpreted? So that's the gray areas will be quite interesting in this. But my view still is aggression is aggression. And I think that if you're a member of NATO, you should be respecting Article 5. On Crimea, I already stated that there was a referendum back when Ukraine got its independence. And I will tell you quite frankly, by the way, in Crimea, the figures that came out for the vote in Crimea, I'm not going to suggest to you that they were a wide margin. They were, I think, about 55% supporting, you know, sticking with Ukraine. But secondly, I will tell you what happened here, I think, has really egregious ramifications for three things. First is about Ukraine. One, because it violates directly, literally, the laws of Ukraine. I mean, it just flies in the face because there was an illegal referendum held in Crimea after the Russian aggression. Basically, it was held at gunpoint. There were people who voted, people who didn't vote. But the Ukrainian law is you don't hold a referendum unless you have, it's part of Ukraine, you know, approval in central, you know, in the center, in Kiev. Secondly, most significantly, I don't know if all of you know about what's called the Budapest Memorandum. It's the Budapest Memorandum of 1994. It's the United States, the UK, and Russia. We all asked Ukraine to give up its nuclear weapons in return for the protection of Ukraine's territorial integrity and its respect for its sovereignty. Ukraine did that. Ukraine did that. Although there was trepidation about what direction, and many countries that went into NATO, they were still concerned about what direction Moscow may go in. But Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. And in this case, this was a breach of it, an outright breach of it in terms of this invasion into Crimea. It has ramifications, not just only for Ukraine, but let me give you an example. At the time of what happened in Ukraine, I was looking at Asian press. And actually, the Japanese were writing story after story about what does this mean for us? The island dispute, by the way, with China? Also, what about extended deterrence? Does this mean, can we count on the United States for, you know, when it comes to some kind of aggression in the Asian arena? There were lots of questions that were raised. So I want to share with you, this is not just about Ukraine. It does have broader ramifications. And thirdly, for those of you who follow non-proliferation, far as I'm concerned, this was an outright undercutting all non-proliferation efforts. You know, if I were sitting in Tehran or in Pyongyang in North Korea, I will tell you I'd be thinking twice about these discussions, you know. So what about, you know, nuclear talks? Look at this and look at what happened and what is the United States, the UK, and Russia doing here? I mean, Russia was the root of it. So it raises a lot of very serious questions. And then finally, you did ask, I think, about the, in that mix in the beginning, I think you asked about sort of the ethnic component. Wasn't that what you said at the beginning?
Right. The justification is that as long as that's you're it. Ethnic Russians that right. want this, then we should be there.
Right. And on that one, as I mentioned, Putin, you know, explicitly stated that in his March 18 speech that he gave. I will tell you that, again, going back to other arenas, let's take Asia. There's great concern. Well, you know, any country, then what does that mean if any country can actually take on that kind of a doctrine? That undercuts literally the kind of institutions and arrangements that we have had in terms of not only international law, post World War II, but also post-Cold War. It literally just smacks and, you know, it's a total affront to it. I want to stick in one thing here because I think it's important. You've asked me about the economic sanctions. You've asked me about military. There's another component here that I personally think is important and that gets undercut or not always looked at, and that is what I'd call the moral narrative. You know, we with Europeans and with many others across the globe have really strived to set up institutions, global institutions, regional institutions for preserving peace. And these actions really defied that. And it's not just only the legality here, but it is about the values that we hold so dearly. Because he refuted it. He said, these are not ours. We're not part of that. And we've had institutions that call for a rule of law, the protection of human rights wherever you are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so in that sense, that's, I think, of great concern, this moral narrative. I think we need to hear more from Western leaders about the protection of these institutions. Because Garrett asked me about what's Putin's motivation. I hear many people also say that he wants to undercut and literally split those institutions, undermine them, show the world that they're feckless, that NATO will not come in, or that the European Union's going to be divided over sanctions. And by the way, you do see in terms of voting throughout Western Europe, if you've watched trends, there are many West European right-of-center parties that are rallying around Putin these days. So he's trying to divide and foment dissension. That's also another part of this here. And the last piece is disinformation. Some people will say, you know, how is it that, my gosh, you know, at home he has high popularity? Well, you know, the press is very much controlled there. And secondly, what is the press giving people? And if you look at it in terms of Russian television, and you may have seen the anchors who have resigned from Russian television, you know, in protest, but bluntly speaking, they have a very effective disinformation machine that repeats some things over and over and over until people start, is it true? And start questioning things. That's another area of disinformation that's part of this picture that needs to be addressed.
Well, lots of hot topics and yes, more discussion to be had, I'm sure. But in the interest of time, let's switch to the optimistic side and opportunities that might be existing.
Okay.
you know.
By the way, there are a number.
Well, how do you feel about, you know, the new government under Mr. Poroshenko? I mean, is he making any good reform and headway against corruption and administrative advances? What do you see?
I will say this. On the optimistic note, in a quick point, actually, because of this aggression more broadly than Ukraine, I think actually many would say it's re-energized, that sometimes there has been a bit of a complacency, and that actually the ironic thing here is that it has injected a kind of energy in our in regional institutions. Mm-hmm. With regard to Ukraine itself, I think that Poroshenko is very committed to, very specifically, to bringing about reform. I think it has been slow. In my view, I would be critical here. I think they need to be doing more. I am very heartened by the recent appointments that have been made. The new finance minister is a Ukrainian-American from Chicago. And I've known her for quite some time. And actually, she's a really tough person. She's going to shake things up. I mentioned to you about the young leader who was head of Naftogaz and who I believe was appointed the Minister of Energy and who said openly, I have my hands full because this is one of the most corrupt sectors. Poroshenko himself can take certain steps that he's been advised to take as a leader to show that it has to be at the top of divorcing yourself from conflicts of interest and from, you know, not only conflicts of interest, but showing that you're not just talking the talk, but you are actually doing it. And in this case, he has certain things that he can and should be doing. He's, as you may know, the chocolate king. He has a chocolate industry and a business. And many have said, what has he done with his own assets? How does he deal with it? And looking at ethical arrangements. So the jury is out on that one. More needs to be done. But they are moving, I think, in the right direction.
Fair enough. Well, Paula, you know, since Yanukovych left, the international community's pledged lots of money to Ukraine. How much of that money has really gotten there, and is it making any positive impact?
Well, I would say I know that the Agency for International Development has given money. I know that there have been other governmental agencies that have given support. I had the benefit the other day of hearing our ambassador, Jeff Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. He gave a readout of, you know, where things are in the U.S. support. And I would say this. I think that it has been the right amount at this time. I think it's been targeted. I think also there's been a view that it has to be watched closely. Part of it deals with some institutional reform. Part of it also deals with training, as I've already suggested. A good chunk of it deals with undertaking the kinds of reforms that are necessary in literally breaking into these kinds of corrupt arrangements that have existed in Ukraine. So in that sense, I would say just generally, from what I know and what I've heard, I think that, again, it's been the right amount, and it's been helping in useful ways at this time.
Well, you know, not to spin the ball back downhill again, but, I mean, the truth of the matter, as you mentioned, the economy is collapsing, you know, by 10%. Exports are falling. Where are the bright spots on that economic horizon for these people?
Come on. You know, in this case, look, you have a country that, A, its leadership before was absolutely corrupt. I mean, when Yanukovych went into Moscow and they showed that mansion over and over, I mean, secondly, Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk's the prime minister, do you know that they opened up the treasury and that literally, I think the figure was something like $30 billion gone? So the new government is dealing with a really rotten deck, okay? Let's start with that. So, you know, in terms of the situation combined with the demonstrations, combined with the provocations, the aggression from Moscow, think about it. How do you do, where do you begin? You know, you have a lot on your hands. So you have to look at that context. But you heard me in answer to your question. I think one of the most important sectors and areas that we, the United States, can actually help is to have Ukraine succeed. By the way, I speak to a number of Russians, Russian elites who are looking at this situation. And you know what I've asked them, and even a few Russian parliamentarians, when you ask them the question, what do you think is the way out of this? They say, look, put Russia over here. You should concentrate on ensuring that Ukraine succeeds economically. Really undertaking these reforms, getting out of this. You know, it's a tough time managing all of these things at once. So the jury is still out here. But I felt we need to look at it in this perspective. And at least the decisions that he's making, Poroshenko, are in the correct direction. I just would like to see some of this move a little bit faster. I always worry because at times as Americans, and I feel, you know, we can be guilty, I'm guilty of it, we always want to see rapid results. And you know, this one is a complex one, and there's a lot that has to be cut, you know, umbilical cords that have to be cut here. And then let me add, you know, Ukraine's trade is also caught up with Russia. I mean, and by the way, you know, I think that's as it naturally in the neighborhood, that's how it should be. But you also have massive corruption here. So there are so many different parts to this. I mean, we could do a whole lecture just on that part alone, not just only in a few minutes.
Well, let me put a pause here. It is at the 1 o'clock hour, and to be sensitive to those of you who might need to leave to get back to the office or meetings and such, please feel free to do so. We're going to continue on here for a few more minutes and then take questions afterwards. So I just wanted to stop and have that announcement made. One last question, and then we'll sort of open it up to the broader audience here. You know, what does the near-term future hold for Ukraine? And to follow up on that, what opportunities do you see for both Ukrainians and the international community?
Well, I'm going to start with, I think that actually, ironically, this is an opportunity for Ukraine. It's a tragic one in terms of what's happening and loss of life, the 100 who died in the Maidan demonstrations. But I'd say that, ironically, there's an opportunity here. And the opportunity here is that Ukraine can really come clean and come clean and actually advance itself economically and literally undertake reforms that will institutionally make a difference. And that's not going to be easy, but it has been so interwoven with this corruption emanating out of Russia. So in this particular case, that's where I do see a silver lining. And secondly, I'd also add the initial overture and the ironic thing when Yanukovych reached out to the European Union Actually, I think that the markets here are valuable, meaning what Ukraine has to offer to Europe, and then also Ukraine's own market in terms of, you know, it being opened and an opportunity for Europeans. That was one of the intents there. Mm-hmm. And in contrast to what was being offered by Moscow, these were going to be no trade barriers. You know, there would be no trade barriers imposed in terms of the kind of trade association resulting from the European, you know, Ukraine's association with the European Union. So I think that there are multiple opportunities here. Ukraine is an important country. It's the size of France. It's at the crossroads of Europe and Asia. It's quite strategic. And actually, for it to fail can have major destabilizing concerns. So I see there being a great opportunity here in this case, fraught with many challenges.
I hear you. Well, for your initial comments, thank you very much. And what we're going to do now is invite questions from the audience, but we have a roving microphone because this is being recorded for rebroadcast. So if you just wait until the microphone gets to you before you ask the question. And again, Paula, thank you. Your comments were very informative.
Thank you.
Hello, thank you for coming.
Sure, tell me who you are.
My name is Jeff Landfield. I live and work here in Anchorage.
Okay,
I'll start by saying I've spent a lot of time in Ukraine and Russia, both East and Western Ukraine. And I guess some of your comments I'm a little concerned by, and I just had two questions. The first one is, do you want to comment on the West, and particularly the U.S. involvement in supporting the protests in Maidan? And, you know, I think creating a lot of the problems that exist now. And also, do you think if Quebec seceded and the Chinese decided to help out with that, we would ignore that? Because, I mean, this is a very, like you said, destabilizing regional conflict. And, you know, since the protests and Yanukovych agreed to have elections and they proceeded on having the revolution, some of the policies out of Kiev regarding language rights in the East were very disturbing. So I think this is a lot more complicated than, you know, a quick discussion, but if you could comment on the West involvement and also the policies out of Kiev after the protests.
Let me start with one of the most, I'd say, important things you mentioned, if I can. You mentioned about the language, and that didn't come up, but let me address it. So to be direct, I do think that, and he raises a very important point, when the new government came in, there was a move in the parliament, the Rada, to literally to say there couldn't be the Russian language. I thought that was a great mistake. But let me also add, all right, I don't know about Latvia. Honestly, I'm in this context, I don't know. But I will say, with regard to Ukraine, which I am very, very familiar with, let me also say you're quite right about that, but they changed it immediately. In fact, I think it was within like 4 or 5 hours that they said, no, this is really inappropriate. And this was a reflection of some of the parliamentarians, but not all, and the leadership, the new leadership, did change that and said that was inappropriate. So he is quite right. That is not the way to go in terms of building consensus and ensuring that everybody is holistic, whether you're Russian or Russian speaker, or meaning a Russian speaking Ukrainian, or you're Ukrainian. Secondly, you said that we were, you know, in the West, you know, that we were provoking or, you know, the Maidan. I would dispute that. And the reason why I dispute that, yes, we did give our views in the sense that we thought it was good in its intent. And the reason why, there were two reasons why they were protesting. A was because they were against the position that Yanukovych took for the association with the European Union. But quite frankly, the second thing was the corruption. Most Ukrainians that I heard, you know, who were demonstrating in there, and they were mostly youth, were demonstrating because of the rampant corruption. I would also go on to say, I think it was wrong that here, you know, there were some 100 people who were killed. And Yanukovych was very, very concerned about that. And there was no need to take out force and violence on them. So in terms of expressing our viewpoints, I believe that we did in that sense. The State Department, I think they brought care packages, I think the Assistant Secretary. But, you know, I viewed this as something that was, certainly the result of a next generation that had it up to here in terms of very specifically what's going on in Ukraine. That's been my perspective, that is my perspective on that.
He did agree to have elections.
I'm sorry?
He did agree to have elections.
He did, but you know what he also did? He disappeared for several days. And I remember the details of that. The Polish ambassador there was on the ground. The Russian ambassador Lukin was in those discussions, along with the French and the German. And Yanukovych signed a document saying, exactly right, that we would hold elections within the span of the year. Also, that we would take action and hold accountable those who killed the 100. There were other little details from that. And then he disappeared. And do you know that they were looking for him, and then he appeared in Moscow. I mean, he abandoned government. I mean, you know, I know the terminology used by Moscow's side is that there was a coup. I don't see it that way. I view that as different. He disappeared. He was gone for days. He also, went to his mansion and vacated, took things out of that mansion, and then went across the border. I have to say that's not the most responsible thing to do here after you sign a document with other leaders. I thought first, initially, when the report came out, that it was a very positive one. I was very heartened by that. And by the way, I'll tell you, I even wrote an op-ed in saying that his overtures initially, you know, vis-a-vis the EU, I thought were the right ones. But what unfolded was, I think, very, very bad all the way around. But I will say his point, and fair enough, because you mentioned, you know, in terms of the ethnic things, that was inappropriate and not a good start for the Ukrainian Rada. But I think the silver lining is there were those who immediately said this is inappropriate and that needs to be done away with. In other words, banning the Russian language.
Paul, a question to you after you left here.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm Paul Dunscombe. I'm chair of the history department here at UAA. And as such, I would be remiss not to thank my colleague Curtis Murphy for assisting us with us on the board for coming up with these questions for you
okay.
today. You used the phrase early on in the talk, Novaya Russia, new Russia.
Well, that's what Putin has
yes.
used. He also called Kazakhstan that Kazakhstan's not a country. Okay.
Well, the thing, though, is that for all they call it New Russia is not a new phrase. It's, in fact, a very old phrase.
True.
So to what extent is what's happening here a function of Putinism, and to what extent is a function of geography? In other words, would this happen even in the absence of Putin or something like this?
Well, I use the term Putinism, and like I said, that was also, by the way, that term, just to be very precise, came out as a discussion with people who supported strongly the reset policy, along with people who supported, which, by the way, for those of you who may or may not know, that's, you know, the reset was looking at Russia and establishing closer relationship and engagement. And then there were people who also were supporting the Magnitsky policy, which was banning a number of Russians here from coming into the United States because of corrupt actions and human rights actions, which was named after Magnitsky, who died in prison. So in this, I think the answer to your question is, in my view, a combination. I mean, look, I think the fact is, and we all know, that there have always been historically close ties between, you know, Russia and Ukraine. Obviously, we could go through many historical, you know, evolutions here. And also, by the way, you heard me say that I also think economically, in fact, I always have felt that the most balanced approach is looking at it from both directions in this case. Because what Ukraine has, you know, there are elements there that are interwoven with Russia, and then also interwoven in the Western direction. But what I would say here is, and I mentioned before, I look at thinking about Gorbachev and his statement about a common European home and his orientation of what he stated. The statements here are just very different in terms of what he's saying. And you have to look at and judge by not only the statements, but also actions. And they're just very different. And here you have a situation where you also have a kind of kleptocracy and a protection of resources and, you know, a kind of cronyism and network that also is being protected. And clearly, clearly, you have a situation where, you know, he is very concerned about his base politically. So I think the answer to you simply is, I think it's a combination here. But it depends on the leadership. That's why I gave the contrast, at least in looking at Gorbachev in that case. Yeah, that was Poroshenko's, what he said. Okay.
And also kind of moral merit. I guess thinking about the U.S. response or military response, it seems that the U.S. is trying to engage, whether it's the European Union or whether it's individual countries in Western Europe to step up themselves. And we're not seeing that so much, although eventually in some sanctions that's happened. But it seemed to me that that was part of the U.S. strategy and not going in here, we're the U.S., we're here to help in visibly geopolitical and even military ways. And I wonder what your thoughts were in that. And I think that also means the U.S., that when you mentioned the Asian countries being more concerned about where the U.S. is, I think the environment is quite different there, where there isn't a coalition of other countries that you're in the region that you're trying to engage. But coming back to Western Europe, where have they been, and should the U.S. wait, or has the U.S. not been very effective in drawing in Western allies?
Well, it's interesting, by the way, your question, and I'm going to connect something back to the gentleman's question here because of you mentioning about the West involvement. I'm not with the administration. But I would say that if an administration official were sitting here, I would imagine they would say that they did not see themselves, because the approach that the administration has taken, actually, you start back with, and let me give this piece, the whole issue of the negotiation with Ukraine over the EU association, it was Europe that led this negotiation. It was Catherine Ashton. And then Catherine Ashton dispatched the people under her to do these negotiations. And quite honestly, some of the Ukrainians, including Yanukovych, complained about this because they didn't like the terms, they didn't like also just the circumstances, but it was Europe that actually did this negotiation, which ultimately failed. And when then you had these demonstrations that started with the issue of the EU association and then really also became a platform for particularly trying to get out a lot of the leaders who were corrupt in Ukraine. So where are we now? You raise an important question, because the way I see it is, I believe that the United States is engaged, and with these sanctions, President Obama has been in Europe, and there have been different overtures, Secretary Kerry, but it's a fact that Europe has, you know, economically, you're more at stake there, and energy-wise, this was the earlier question. So you know, they are looking at what are the issues for them in these sanctions. I think if I had to pick out the person who has been really leading this in the European arena, has been Angela Merkel. You know, she's time and again out there, and she's been the one who's tried to hold Europe together. But that leads me to the third. If you're asking me, is it unified? I would say that it's hanging together, but whether we go, as we go into 2015, will it continue to hang together? I would question it. Italy, for example, has really protested against the policies. You know, I think Putin was there, and Berlusconi, you know, was there, and you know, he was received. There are a number of European leaders that I could cite where they've given a different platform. Another one, Hungary. Orban of Hungary. I think that recently there was a nuclear deal that I think was concluded. And then some statements made. So the bottom line is, in my view, the way I see it, it is hanging together. okay, in the context of these sanctions. But when we go into next year, will that remain the same, A? And then B, it's not just about sanctions, but also politically, how, you know, countries are together. They're not all together. It's a challenge. And you do raise a very important point. And that comes back to Putin, President Putin. I think he sees opportunities here, you know, opportunities that benefit his own strategy here.
Hi, my name is Archana Mishra, and I work at the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation here and also a board member of Alaska World Affairs Council. So glad I could be here today and hear from you. A couple of things that I heard from your talk is the need for Ukraine going forward. It's very clear that they need to be focused on their economic development, but at the same time, I heard that their specific need from USA is lethal weapon. How do we reconcile both those needs, and how are those two aligned in terms of time frame going forward?
Well, you know, they're obviously different, and also my point even about disinformation and even the moral narrative. These are all different sectors, and they all would achieve and impact Ukraine in different ways. I personally would pick out, I do think the issue of Ukraine succeeding economically would matter greatly. And I also think it is an opportunity, as I did say, for Ukraine in really combating corruption and really changing. That actually is one of the biggest threats for the East, meaning east of Ukraine, because that isn't the way it's been. So secondly, as I said, the reason why I do support the other, which is separate, is because A, they have asked for it. B, it's not just a military issue, because most military would say, well, when you look at, okay, who wins or what does it really mean? I see it more because of, as I said, the political context of it. It connotes a support for the cause of what Ukraine is trying to do. It's interesting, I wrote an op-ed, and let me just say this in a bipartisan way, I cited Bill and Hillary Clinton. And the reason why, they were in Yalta for a conference when Yalta was part of Ukraine, it's still part of Ukraine as far as I'm concerned, but they were there, and you know what they said? They said to everyone, let Ukraine make its own choices. You know, and by the way, it could be a combination of things here. Doesn't have to be, it's a line here and this is off and that's off. You know, and in that sense, I just think that this is something that they've asked for, but it does send a kind of a signal of a support or a lack of support for them. And for me, I see it as more falling in the context of political and maybe even what I'd call psychological. But the point of the economic and the development, I think, is actually the most crucial. And let me repeat again, I've had the occasion to speak to a number of Russians who've been very outspoken. They've been critical of a number of things. But the one thing, at least, I have found that we are very much united on is this very point, actually, is the economy. Because also, if Ukraine fails, it really is going to be detrimental in so many different ways.
One last question out there in the back, and then we'll wind things up.
Thank you for coming and talk to us. My name is Rick Goodfellow. I'm a local broadcaster. When Mr. Wong asked you if sanctions against Russia were effective, you didn't hesitate at all. You said yes. What's the metric? Harm to the Russian economy or moderation of their policy?
I think it's a combination of factors. One, I first would start with what they themselves have said, meaning a number of Russians have said in terms of the impact as they see. Not only those in the government, but those out of government, you know, stating. And that's one thing where they have a commonality on. The second is, yes, you look at the indicators and the metrics. And here you look at the ruble has plummeted. You look at the fact that also, as you know, the gas prices, oil prices have gone, you know, have plummeted. Also, investment, when you look at the figures, Ernst & Young does a lot in terms of, you know, figures. Also, so does the U.S.-Russia Business Council. You can look at some of the data there. And then let me give another one, and that is Kudrin, who was a former official in Russia, also talked about the figures of capital flight. And the capital flight, believe it or not, I remember saying this in a forum. It was a little private forum. I was reading that Kudrin said that there were billions of dollars of capital flight by the end of this year. Admittedly, I can't tell you right at this moment what the precise figure is. I want to look at it because there are probably going to be different figures rendered. But the fact is that capital flight is pretty massive. So is all of this a result of sanctions? No, I would not necessarily say that. But I do think that it has exacerbated the situation. I think, personally, a lot of it is attributable to the policies on the ground there and also a lack of modernization in Russia itself. But I'd also round out the question, which I think we did. I think sanctions are an important component, but they're not the only one, definitely. And also, as we know, sanctions in certain sectors, they take a long time to really have an impact. Consistency of approach makes a difference. And the previous question from the woman who asked about Europe, I'd say going into 2015, I'd have a real concern about the unity of approach here. I hope that it does continue if there's no change in the circumstance. By the way, I just wanted to say this in conclusion. I've been wanting to say this. If an opportunity in coming here and being able to speak before you, I do have to say I've never, ever have had a seat that is so magnificent as this one. Because I look at you, I'm serious. As I look at each of you, I kept wondering and looking there. I'm serious. It's really, really just gorgeous.
Well, Paula, you know, we're going to welcome you back at any time you'd like to come and speak to us on these geopolitical issues of significance. And I want to thank you, on behalf of everybody in the room, the Anchorage East Rotarians and World Affairs Council members, for taking the long journey to be here with us. I know you have to head back this evening. But thank you again for being here and sharing your great ideas.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thanks.
Thank you. And I'm not sure if Acting President Dave, you need anything. But with that, the meeting's adjourned. If you have not given any consideration, please give some consideration to becoming a member of the Alaska World Affairs Council. Bye-bye.